And counsel, while you guys are getting situated, I will welcome you here to the Court of Appeals. I'm Judge Paul Harris. With me today are Judge Kiala Eid and Judge Elizabeth Bentley. In the moment, you are going to begin your oral argument. Each of you will have 15 minutes for your initial argument, with the appellant having 5 minutes for a rebuttal. Just a reminder, this is being recorded. I will ask that you please state your name at the beginning of each leg of your argument. On the podium, there is a button to adjust the podium to the height you prefer. With that, we are now calling 824-1163, Thomas Grazer, respondent versus the state of Minnesota, appellant. I will have the appellant begin when you are ready.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. I am Senior Assistant Hennepin County Attorney Adam Petrus, and I represent the appellant, the state of Minnesota, in this matter. The issue in this appeal is whether the Sixth Amendment and the corresponding Minnesota constitutional provision require that all attorneys, in order to provide objectively reasonable assistance, interpret the information in that May 2, 2019 Edina Police Department summary to constitute a report under the 2009 version of Minnesota Statute Section 628.26 Clause E, as the statutory language, quote, offense was reported to law enforcement authorities, end quote, had been defined up until 2022 or 2023. And the answer is no. The Sixth Amendment and the Minnesota Constitution do not require that. And under the unique circumstances present, both factually in this case and in light of available controlling legal authority, it was reasonable for Alan Kaplan and Hillary Parsons, two seasoned criminal defense attorneys who focus their practices on criminal sexual conduct prosecutions, to choose not to challenge the first-degree criminal sexual conduct charge in this case on statute of limitation grounds. A critical fact in this appeal is that the victim in that May 2, 2019 Edina Police summary said she, quote, lied, end quote, that any sexual abuse had occurred.
Can I ask this, you a question?
Of course.
Your reasonableness argument. So would you, is it the state's position that the reasonableness determination shouldn't depend on the attorneys relying on non-precedential opinions since they're not binding?
I believe that, if I understand your question correctly, Judge Eid, no, I don't think that, I mean, the attorney's decision, they were guided by non-precedential decision, but there was no precedential authority that required them to act in a certain way. Am I answering your question?
Yes. So then, because your colleague makes a plain language argument.
Right? He does.
And so if we can't say that defense counsel are required to rely on non-precedential, non-binding opinions of this court, then we're left with the plain language and the established case law on statutory interpretation, right?
And correct.
And it looks like the way the parties discuss it, the key precedential case that gets close to this issue is Sukup, if I'm pronouncing that right.
That's how I pronounce it.
Okay, so my question about your view of Sukup is that you seem to rely most heavily on the syllabus point, right?
Correct.
And you've cited it a number of times throughout your brief, both briefs. And so the way you've emphasized the language in the syllabus point, it seems to me, disregards the preamble to that syllabus point and the facts of Suka. And here's what I mean by that, and I want you to tell me why this would be wrong. So the beginning of the syllabus point is for a victim to report sexual abuse, triggering the statute of limitations set forth in 628.26, the victim must report the abuse to law enforcement authorities, not merely disclose it to a relative. So the sentence presumes that it's the victim doing the reporting, right? Do you agree?
Can I answer why that is? Yeah, I mean, that's what the 1995 version of 628.26 Clause E said.
But wouldn't you also agree that the reason is that there's no third-party report in Sukup? There's no...
Factually speaking. Right. The family member or the relative that it was reported to did not then in turn report it to law enforcement.
Right. And,
right.
And so there, and it wasn't reported in this case to a therapist who then reported it to Child Protective Services who then reported it to the police, right?
I mean, I can agree with what Judge Paul Scoggin wrote in his post-conviction order in this case, that there is no case in Minnesota, precedential or non-precedential, and that includes Sukup, that is square on all fours with the fact pattern that we have here.
Right, but Sukup then, you know, the holding in Sukup seemed to favor your counterpart in that, you know, the court holds that a report is a report to law enforcement, and reporting the statute means notifying law enforcement, and that tracks with the language, even the language of the 1995 statute, you know, which doesn't even seem to require that it be a victim doing the reporting in the 1995 statute, because the key language is was reported to law enforcement authorities, and that's consistent with the statute at issue in 2009, right, where it's a report to law enforcement. So, I mean, it doesn't identify who or the offense was reported to law enforcement as a language in E in the 2009 version. So it doesn't require that it be a victim doing the reporting, is my point. Sukup doesn't require that. It doesn't say the only person that can do this is the victim, right?
It doesn't explicitly say that, but I'm going to push back on, I believe, the point that you're driving at, if I may. And that's, I mean, in Judge Ross, when he wrote Sukup, I mean, he was looking at the 1995 version, which had that victim language that I don't have exactly in front of me. I can pull it up and speak to it verbatim on rebuttal. Well, but that was excised from the 2009 version that's at issue in this case.
I think that's important because it just says, if the victim failed to report the offense within this limitation period, comma, within 3 years after the offense was reported. So again, it uses this passive voice, the offense was reported. And that's very similar to the 2009 version of the statute that everyone agrees is controlling here, is after the offense was reported. So there's no actor that's doing that. The offense could be reported by anyone.
And Judge Rossin's opinion in Sukup did talk about the word report and then the word reported, the two separate clauses in that sentence meaning the same thing. And then what the legislature did, of course, was they removed that first portion. So what we're left after Sukup and after the legislative change to 628.26 is just that analysis that had part of its basis removed. So in that sense, Sukup is not controlling. But I want to direct you to pin site 922 in Sukup, in which this court in a precedential decision wrote, the practical end of Sukup's theory is that when a sexually abused child privately reveals the abuse to anyone and by any means, her abuse is forever removed from the statutory exception designed to extend the limitations period for young victims who do not report their abusers promptly. We cannot accept this to be the intended consequence of an exception designed to expand rather than limit the statutory period in which the state may charge sex offenders.
But that's because there's no third-party report in Sukup,
right?
And there's no report to law enforcement in Sukup.
Correct. Factually, it is not on all fours with this case.
Absolutely, it's not on all fours with this case because it's a different statute, as we've already talked about. But, I mean, the important thing in Sukup is that there was never a report to law enforcement.
That's true.
I mean,
I think kind of related to this point, but if you were just quoting at pin site 922, if you go like two paragraphs down.
Mm-hmm.
The court says, additionally, we observed that the statutory scheme mandates reporting of maltreatment. So it talks about the mandatory reporter and uses the idea of mandatory reporting to inform at the end of that sentence. You know, it takes from that, you know, because at the end it says it instructs those persons who are mandated reporters to make the report to the official agency. And because we conclude reporting means notifying law enforcement authorities, My point there, I guess, is to say, didn't Sukup like consider mandatory reporters like we have in the facts of this case to define what would have made what an appropriate report is under the statute, which would include a mandatory reporter to a law enforcement agency?
It may have, but I mean, building on that 922 pin site that I just said, I mean, we have the information that we have in this case is we have a private disclosure to a therapist, which is 100% absolutely privileged information. I understand the mandatory reporter piece that's in Sukup, but
still presuming that the victim has to be doing the reporting then? I mean, it doesn't matter who reports it, right, under the plain language of the statute.
I mean,
as long as it's a report to law enforcement.
If we were looking at this from an academic perspective, I can understand where you're coming from, Judge Eade. But we have to remember what claim is actually before this court today, and that's ineffective assistance of trial counsel governed by Strickland. So you can't look at it exactly as we're looking at right now. You have to look at it as you have that half-page narrative, the fourth page of exhibit post-conviction exhibit one, and that's your information. And you have this description of the victim apparently telling something to the therapist, who then apparently told something to child protection, who then apparently told something to Detective Dick. I'm sorry for getting too close there. And then you have, you know, Detective Dick then going back to the original source
Do we even need to worry about what Detective Dick does afterwards? I mean, because if we clear everything away, right, we don't have Sukup directly on all fours.
Yep.
We have these non-precedential opinions. We're left with the plain language of the statute and the law of statutory interpretation and the case law about statutory interpretation. And we have a report to law enforcement. It's documented in a police report. And so it would seem to me that when it's a delayed reporting case like this, like Judge Scoggin said, that, I mean, when we look at it the other way, you know, we have to think about the way they looked at it at the time. Why shouldn't we conclude that it seems like they were lawyering the client? You know, they were looking for ways not to file the statute of limitations motion to dismiss. I mean, she recanted. That's not in the statute. It doesn't say anything about what happens to the investigation. It doesn't say anything about the prosecution's ability to file the case, like you argue in your brief. All it says is a report to law enforcement.
I mean, the standard from non-binding decisions from this court, if we're looking at Keller and Avila, I want to get the exact language in front of me, includes enough detail to put law enforcement on notice that a specific criminal offense may have occurred. Personally, I don't see that all that different from having an honest and strong suspicion that a person under consideration committed a crime, which, of course, is the standard for probable cause. So I think those two are fairly similar. But we have to remember what Mr. Kaplan and what Ms. Parsons did with that information. They didn't ignore it, or they didn't do a poor job of trying to obtain it, like in Nix, the Minnesota Supreme Court decision from 2013. They strategically used that information in the May 2nd, 2019 police summary to their advantage. They tried to build their defense theory of the case.
We had the victim. Both? I mean, Mr. Richmond argues that they could have filed the motion to dismiss, fully litigated it, and then still impeached the victim at trial.
Under the way the Sixth Amendment has been interpreted by this court and by the Minnesota Supreme Court in presidential or, for frankly, non-presidential decisions, Keeler and Avila obviously are not ineffective assistance of counsel cases. But I don't believe that the Sixth Amendment requires defense attorneys to do that. There's a fair amount of deference paid when information is provided in discovery and defense attorneys make an informed, tactical, strategic decision about how to utilize that information.
Right, hey. Like one of the cases where someone decided not to file a motion to dismiss on statute of limitations ground because they wanted the lesser offense to be considered by the jury, so the jury had a chance to acquit.
That happened in Reed, I know.
Right?
Yes.
But what is the analog to that in this case?
Like, why did they do this? The testimony from the post-conviction hearing is they think it wasn't worth it. And, I mean, Ms. Parsons and Mr. Kaplan.
It isn't a strategic advantage at trial.
I mean, there's specific testimony from Ms. Parsons at the post-conviction hearing where she has gotten slapped around and gotten in trouble with these trial judges in Hennepin County when she is making arguments that they think are meritless and worthless, and she wants to, like, maintain her capital for other cases or for other motions that she intends to litigate. She's trying to.
That kind of the big question then is, was this a meritless argument? And I think the point in the expert, at least, that testified below was that this wasn't meritless. If you'd read Sukup, if you read the plain language of the statute, read Sukup, one of them said they read Keller, which actually kind of points towards the fact that there may be a basis, even if somebody is not, maybe it's not a recantation, but it's a lack of witness cooperation or victim cooperation. That at least there's something, there's an argument there, and if you win it, then it's dispositive. So that seems to me to be the question is, was this objectively reasonable for them to say this was, in effect, maybe not a frivolous argument, but not a worthwhile one?
I mean, if you're saying the Sixth Amendment requires
all defense attorneys to spot this issue when you have that initial half-page narrative police summary in which the victim is saying, no, I lied, there was no sexual abuse. That'd be a brand new rule of law in Minnesota. And this court could announce that in a presidential decision, absolutely.
But don't we need to read into the statute? I mean, in what you just said, don't we need to read into the statute, report to law enforcement that was not recanted, or report to law enforcement that prosecution decides to file? Like, it seems like you're asking us to read the 2009 version of the statute, read language into it that's not there. And if we set aside everything else, again, going back to the plain language, how do we do that?
I don't think I'm asking you to add language to the statute. I think I'm asking you to interpret report or allow some discretion from experienced defense attorneys to interpret report based on the facts as they're presented to them in this case. And they didn't see that as a report. My office didn't see that as a report. Otherwise, we wouldn't have charged the case. I mean, we can't charge things that are barred by the statute of limitations. There are many experienced criminal practitioners that did not see it that way. And I understand Mr. Richmond and now Judge Scoggin are seeing it, you know, on the other side. But it's not like that was the only way to look at the word report.
Is not the operative. The charge doesn't appear in the statute, right?
No, I agree the charge doesn't appear in the statute, but what does appear, I guess, again, in the non-binding Keller and Avila decisions, which I think are the most helpful in terms of interpreting what triggers that statute of limitations under this particular clause. Judge Harrison, I apologize. I'm seeing out of time. May I finish my?
Absolutely.
Thank you. That language being includes enough detail to put law enforcement on notice that a specific criminal offense may have occurred. And in the information that the defense attorneys, Mr. Kaplan and Ms. Parsons, had in front of them, they had the victim explicitly denying
we're talking about the statute talks about report. And the report from the CPS authority to law enforcement had the who, what, where, when-ish, you know, what those basic facts about what happened. I get it that after the fact, law enforcement calls the victim who, you know, recants or says that none of that was true, but the statute of limitations is triggered by the report, which had enough to put them on notice that some crime had occurred. Right?
I'll push back on the after the fact. This all happened within a 24 period hour of time, as I understand, on May 1st and May 2nd, 2019. And what I don't see it any different. And Judge Harris, I can save my comments for rebuttal.
Go ahead. You can finish your thought, and then we'll move forward.
I don't see it any different than, you know, Judge Bentley being in charge of the Minnesota Court of Appeals summer softball team. And Judge Bentley telling Judge Harris that the first game for the summer softball team is on Saturday night. And Judge Harris then telling Judge Eade that the first game is on Saturday night. And then Judge Eade telling the marshal that the first game is on Saturday night. And all this information compiled together. And then the marshal asking Judge Bentley, and she's like, there wasn't enough interest. We don't actually have a softball team. Is that a report that there's a softball game on Saturday night? Or is that a report when looked in its, you know, entirety, in that half-page narrative, that there actually isn't?
Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court, my name is Robert Richmond. I represent Thomas Graetzer. When a criminal defense attorney fails to raise a dispositive motion that, given the law, has a significant chance of success and does so because of an egregious misunderstanding of the relevant law, that attorney's performance is constitutionally ineffective. This is not a close case. In 2022, Dr. Graetzer was charged with an offense that allegedly occurred 14 years earlier. That would immediately put competent counsel on notice that they should be closely focusing on the statute of limitations. As this court said in Sukup, and I agree with you, Judge Eade, that case supports our position, the statute of limitations is unambiguous. It sets a 3-year statutory period from the date, quote, the offense was reported to law enforcement authorities. Because reported is not defined in the statute, we look to dictionary definitions, and in Sukup, this court defined report to mean notifying law enforcement authorities. There is nothing in the statute that requires that the report establish probable cause, that it allows the state to pursue a prosecution without further investigation. There is nothing in the statute that requires the victim to cooperate. There is no serious question that given the plain language of the statute, the report by Child Protection Services on May 2nd, 2019 was a report triggering the statute of limitations. Sergeant Dick described the CPS communication as a report, as did trial counsel. Plainly, that report put law enforcement on notice that a specific crime may have been committed. The report was specific, it was formal, it came from the agency whose legislative mission is the protection of children. It detailed the identity of the alleged perpetrator, the identity of the alleged victim, the time, period, the place where the crime allegedly occurred, and other possible witnesses.
Mr. Richmond, can I ask you, Judge Scoggin found both Ms. Parsons and Mr. Kaplan to be credible witnesses, found their testimony credible. And one of the arguments that the state is making is that there were strategic reasons why counsel would have decided not to file this motion, one of them being to avoid additional evidence about active coercion and coming out at trial, the other being to not make the trial judge annoyed, essentially, with what they viewed as a meritless motion. Why shouldn't we conclude that counsel's performance was reasonable based on those arguments?
Both Ms. Parsons and Mr. Kaplan said both said that they agreed that the 9-year statute of limitations had elapsed. They were not concerned about tolling under Danielski, and Ms. Parsons specifically said that the notion that additional evidence of coercion, that fear did not occur to her until I filed my petition. It was not part of her thinking at the time that she chose not to file the motion to dismiss. Under Strickland, we look at the circumstances through the eyes of the attorney at the time.
The act of coercion on the tolling piece, but the act of coercion as evidence at trial to undercut attempts to impeach the victims, that's how I understood it, is that they didn't want to, by filing the pretrial motion to dismiss, the record would be developed on active coercion. Well, I guess you're saying she didn't consider it at that time.
Correct.
At the time of deciding not to file the pretrial motion to dismiss.
Correct. That only in thinking about it after the fact did she say, huh, if I had filed that motion, that might have led to additional evidence of active coercion. She agreed that that was not one of her considerations at the time that she chose not to file the motion. I believe she also agreed that she wasn't concerned about pissing off a judge. And given what I think, given the plain state of the law, any competent criminal defense attorney would see was a meritorious motion, it would not be a reasonable strategy to not make what could be a dispositive motion with a significant chance of success on the off chance that a judge might be annoyed at you. That's what criminal defense lawyers do.
Attorney's job can often be characterized as annoying judges, right?
I think that's part of the mission, Your Honor.
Can I ask you, Judge Scoggins seemed to rely on Keller and Avila in reaching his conclusion, and you make that argument too. I mean, I don't know if, I mean, to the state's point, I don't know if a good rule of law would be that defense counsel need to rely on non-precedential opinions of this court when we repeatedly referred them as non-binding. If we conclude that Judge Scoggin was wrong to rely on Avila and Keller in deciding that trial counsel's performance was not reasonable, then Do you lose?
I think that I win under the plain language of the statute, Your Honor. But I certainly think that Keller and Avila provide persuasive authority that was persuasive to Judge Scoggin, and I think it should be persuasive to this court because of the fact that those decisions were grounded on the plain language of the statute. So taking the plain language of the statute, applying the particular facts in those cases that led Avila to say that a town rumor repeated by the baker was not a report, whereas in Keller, a report from Child Protection Services, just as here, was a report, notwithstanding the fact that the victim completely stymied the investigation. In Keller...
This is different, though, than Keller, because it's one thing to stymie the investigation, not cooperate, but it's another thing to totally recant. Say, I lied, it's not true, it didn't happen. Don't file a report. This is... So in that sense, it's almost like, you know, everybody here who was involved at that, at least in the law enforcement side, and then also it seems like once it got to this issue of the statute of limitations when he finally was charged, viewed that recantation as almost like nullifying the report that had been made. And why, you know, maybe we can make a statutory interpretation argument if we're deciding in the first instance, but why, when you're looking at reasonableness of how the attorneys were viewing that situation, is it unreasonable? Was it unreasonable for them, for the county attorney's office, for folks involved to say, listen, that wasn't a real report because it was totally recanted within 24 hours?
I think going down, first of all, there is nothing in the statute that, I think what makes our case very similar to Keller is Keller stands for the proposition that the information has to be enough to put the police on notice, but it doesn't have to be enough to lead to a successful investigation. In Keller, they were unable to even identify the alleged perpetrator. There was nothing they could do. In our case is much stronger than Keller, that there was a report, because notwithstanding the recantation, the police had all sorts of avenues of investigation that they could have pursued. They could have confronted Dr. Graetzer with the allegations. In Sukup, when that happened, the defendant confessed. They could have reviewed his disciplinary files with the medical board. They could have spoken to his wife, who was now divorced from him, who lived in the house when these allegations took place, and the other people who lived in the house. There is nothing in the statute that suggests that this court should determine whether there is or isn't a report based on the status of the investigation.
But what about the fact that the, you know, the police report uses the language that, you know, that the victim said she lied and does not want any report made, in connection with Sukup syllabus point, which I think on its face seems to support the state's argument about the telephone hypothetical that was given. Why wouldn't it have been reasonable for trial counsel to look at the police report and see, well, at the end, the victim didn't want a report to be made. Sukup says for a victim to make a report for purposes of the statute of limitations, the victim needs to report it to law enforcement, and then conclude, well, there isn't a motion here.
Well, had trial counsel actually read Sukup, they would have seen that Sukup was based on the 1995 version of the statute of limitations, which states if the victim failed to report the offense within this limitation period, which language does not occur in our statute. So the language about a victim reporting has no application in our case, because our statute makes absolutely clear that all that has to happen is that the offense was reported.
Do you read the 1995 language to require a victim to make a report? As I was asking earlier, you know, that just seems to be a premise that to the latter part of the sentence. The victim doesn't make a report within the original period.
The defendant's position in Sukup was, the language was, if the victim failed to report the offense within this limitation period, then 3 years after the time the report, the offense was reported to law enforcement. And the defendant said, well, the first clause about the victim does not refer to law enforcement, so that report could be to anyone, including, in this case, the cousin. I think that in order, under the way that that 1995 version has been interpreted by the courts, is that the 9-year statute applies unless the victim reports within that 9 years. If the victim doesn't report within those 9 years, then anyone can report in the subsequent period. I mean, that's what the statute literally says. It leads to the strange result that the cousin could have reported to law enforcement. Well, if it's reported to law enforcement within those 9 years, I think the 3 years from that reporting date would still apply. I mean, the 1995 statute was not well drafted, but that problem has been eliminated in the current version. The state's argument in this case is that counsel acts reasonably in failing to raise a dispositive motion unless there is controlling authority factually identical to the instant case that compels the conclusion that the motion will succeed. That position just fundamentally misconstrues the nature of the defense function and would gut the protections of the Sixth Amendment.
I thought your argument was there, in any cases, that there is controlling authority here, and that's the plain language of the statute.
Exactly, Your Honor. I don't think that, and Judge Scoggin treated this as an area that is unsettled in the law. I don't believe that it is unsettled. I think that the plain language of the statute, the preference that courts give to repose in statute of limitations cases, as well as the persuasive authority, makes this not a case of unsettled law. But even if it was, even if you treat this as unsettled, all of the data points support that a motion should have been filed. This isn't a case that sometimes occurs where the Supreme Court simply overturns controlling precedent in a way that competent counsel could not reasonably have anticipated. This is not a case in which there are conflicting decisions, some that point to this is a report, some that point to it's not. What we have here is a post hoc rationalization by trial counsel saying, well, there was a report which was then eviscerated by denial. There is no support in the case law, in the language of the statute, that supports that proposition. It's just made up. And if we go down the road that you suggested, Judge Bentley, we will then have a situation where originally there's a report when CPS notifies law enforcement, which, if it remains a report, I guess, until they speak to AG, who, if she denies the allegation, now we no longer have a report. Maybe the report gets resurrected if they do additional investigation and get further down the road. But what Keller makes clear and is persuasive because the statute makes clear, the existence of a report does not depend on the status or success of the investigation. For those reasons, we would ask the court to affirm Judge Scoggin. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
I'm back. I want to direct your attention to pages 72 to 74 of the first post-conviction evidentiary hearing transcript. It was on March 11th of earlier, I guess last year. And there, Ms. Parson is testifying, and she talks about the three different reasons that they did not necessarily bring that motion in this case. And one of those two, and I take your point, Judge Eid, about one of the purposes perhaps of defense counsel is to frustrate or annoy at times. But she just specifically testifies it was a strategic choice to not annoy a judge by bringing a motion when they were concerned that the judge may not feel that motion is valid. Another aspect that she specifically testifies to under oath, and as was pointed out before, Judge Scoggin found her credible, is that it impacts the offers that she would receive on behalf of her client from the state. If you're to file a motion to dismiss for on statute of limitation grounds and the, you know, coercive or parental authority doctrine comes into play, that would require a pretrial hearing in which the state would have to bring in the victim before the trial to testify to lay the groundwork for some of that. And that's longstanding.
It also improved your bargaining position if you have a pending motion to dismiss that might, I mean, for the defense.
Again, it depends on maybe the assessment of the likelihood of success of that particular motion. But in terms of needing to, she specifically testified her concern was that, you know, having the victim, you know, come in and testify beforehand could impact the ability of getting a more favorable offer from the state. Not necessarily in every single case, but again, case dependent. She was really emphasizing that in her testimony. And the last thing I want to draw your attention to in her testimony is just what she poured into this particular case and the motions that she did bring and the work that she did provide to Mr. Gratzer. And yes, she did not file this particular motion. I understand Mr. Richmond's characterization of it as being dispositive. And if it is statutorily time barred, it is dispositive. I can concede that. But what the Sixth Amendment fundamentally requires is a hotly contested, fairly litigated, full-throated defense. And that is exactly what Mr. Gratzer received in this case from two extremely experienced defense attorneys, specifically experienced in criminal sexual conduct prosecutions.
And I think that the issue really comes down to, like, how good of an argument was it? Because all the reasons that you're saying, if it really was, if there was not a good chance that the court would grant a motion to dismiss, or not a remote chance, or, you know, then you could see where not you don't want to annoy the judge, you're going to focus on all your other motions, you're going to, like, think how it plays into bargaining. But I think the ultimate question is looking at the case law, the plain language of the statute and the case law, was it a good enough argument that an objectively reasonable lawyer in that situation would have brought it, despite any other of those concerns. So it's not to say that they didn't have other reasons. But you know, again, I think it comes down to looking at the plain language, looking at Sukup, maybe considering the non-precedential. We know that at least they read them, or at least one of them read one or two of the cases, right? so I think it still does come down to the strength of the argument.
I see your point, Judge Bentley. And I think that there's reasonable minds may disagree on the strength of that argument. And I think that's exactly what the Sixth Amendment stands for, is it needs to be objectively unreasonable in which to withstand. I think the fact that you have lied, you have that unique fact that Mr. Gratzer's own expert at the post-conviction hearing testified about the facts and circumstances in this case being unique and unparalleled when compared to every other case that he had researched and was prepared for going in here. You had that different than Keller in that respect, because you had that, you know, complete denial and retraction right out of the gate when the defense attorneys are first looking at the information that had been provided from child protection, that had been provided from the therapist, that had apparently been originally provided in that private therapy session. And so I understand your point about the merits of the argument mattering here, and I think that those merits were simply questionable given the non-precedential nature of Keller and Avila, given that they are not square, given the perhaps distinction between what you see in the syllabus point in Sukup and then what you have in some of the analysis, like the mandatory reporter paragraph you pointed me to before. And I think that law was just unsettled.
Well, so then if it's unsettled, so let's take that, then, you know, and I understand that we typically don't hold attorneys to being able to come up with how the law is going to develop or to predict some change in the law down the line or to be the one on the front lines of changing some aspect. But this, like, help me understand why this is that. Because here, what I see is the plain language and Sukup, if anything, saying a report to a law enforcement officer from anybody that has the who, what, where, when is a report, and the recantation here is almost like the change in the law. Like the fact that here, oh, but this is different because there's a recantation. Like that to me seems like taking the law in a different direction from where it was going, which is just any report that's not from that's to law enforcement. So why isn't that the change in the law that they shouldn't have anticipated? And in fact, they should have been moving ahead, which was, or at least following kind of the train of where the law was, which was any report matters.
Judge Harris, I see that I'm out of time. May I have a chance to ask a clarifying question and then respond?
Please. Hey,
Judge Bentley, just so I'm tracking, are you talking about the change in the law being the legislature's change between the 1995 version? And
No.
I apologize.
I'm talking about like how, as I understand the state's position, you're saying that the law was unsettled. So we can't expect that the lawyers would have anticipated that the recantation doesn't matter, or that this report certainly was. So that is the unsettled law. But I guess my question is, this doesn't strike me as that type of trying to anticipate where the law is going, because the law was, just as if you take it on its face, the plain language of the statute, a report to law enforcement. We have Sukup talking about a report to law enforcement. It seems like kind of the status quo was the report to law enforcement was a report under the statute. And if anything, the changing factor is, oh, this is different because she recanted. So I guess what I'm trying to get at is it seems to me like the status quo of where the law was sitting was actually that a report to law enforcement is a report and the statute of limitations applies. And the recantation would actually be the change that they maybe – we wouldn't necessarily think that they would have anticipated that. Are you tracking?
I am. Okay. I appreciate it. Thank you for clarifying. No, I think it really comes down to a point that Mr. Richmond raised in his respondent's brief and that I tried to address in my reply brief, which is, where is the report actually happening? Is it the piece of information that is flowing from the victim to the therapist to child protection to the police and then the and just that? Or is it the what's oftentimes referred to as a police report, but that fourth half-page narrative, you know, the fourth page of Post-Conviction Exhibit 1, in which you have, you know, a couple sentences summarizing that, but then you also have the immediate follow-up from Detective Dick to the victim, in which she categorically denied that that happened by saying, I had lied about that.
So when, and sorry, just if I can have one more question here. When then is, like, what if the recantation had been a week later? Or a month later? Would that have been a different case?
I think it would. I think without the word lied in that police report, this is a different case. I think if you put some space in between those two things, this is a different case. But that is what fundamentally makes it different than Keller and Tomlinson, is that you had all that information, again, being reviewed over 3 years later by these seasoned defense attorneys when they're looking at this half-page narrative. And that's the first time anyone's ever looking at this, because it wasn't submitted to the state for charging consideration because of Detective Dick's assessment that there was not a specific criminal offense that she was aware of based on that information, again, in that half-page narrative. I apologize for going way over, Judge Harris.
Okay, thank you. With that, this matter has been submitted. We will issue an order in the statutory time frame. Thank you both.